Mio felt uncharacteristically nervous the next morning, as she dressed in her uniform, put on her new flight goggles, made certain her swords were secure on her back, and then went outside to face her final trial. After everything she'd faced, everything she'd attained, in these last few strange and wondrous months, it would be such a horrible anticlimax if she proved unable to activate a striker again. And yet how big an ingrate would she feel for being disappointed by that, in the face of everything else she'd gained and regained? Still, she couldn't deny that she would be, if it came down to it. Griffin didn't seem worried, but then he hadn't right along. Before every one of the hurdles and milestones she'd faced on this odyssey, he'd been right there, exuding confidence that she would succeed. Now she found him standing out in the clearing, dressed very much like the way he'd been when she'd first seen him, back in 1943. Heavy duck trousers, paratrooper boots, a sheepskin bomber jacket, and the sleek, brushed silver double pod of a jetpack. This one looked slightly more advanced than the one he'd had in 43, which made sense if it was decades later for him, as he'd told her. Her striker unit stood next to him, affixed to an improvised launch stage he'd constructed while she was dressing and preparing herself. Mio had to admit it wasn't the most sophisticated apparatus she'd ever seen. It consisted primarily of a couple of old wooden sawhorses, a plank, a short stepladder, and a few bungees. But it was doing the job of keeping the unit upright and providing a way to get to the top of it, and under the circumstances, that was all she could really ask. "Are you ready?" Griffin asked, smiling. "No," Mio replied honestly. "But it's time." He grinned, kissed her on the cheek, for luck, and steadied the ladder for her as she mounted to the top of the platform. Standing there, feeling the old wood rough under the soles of her bare feet, she looked down into the open throats of her striker for a moment, steeling herself for whatever might happen next. And then stepped off, pointing her toes as she was taught long ago, and sliding down into the unit's embrace. There was that familiar faint vibration as the magic engine spun up, and for an eternal gliding moment it seemed like nothing else would happen. Then a strange new sensation, like a door opening within her, and the striker glowed, its control surfaces twitching. She looked down at her hands and saw that they were glowing too, the familiar manifestation of a visible aura, as the striker's magic engine synchronized with her own energies. The tingling sensation in her scalp and at the base of her spine that told her the ears and tail of her spirit familiar were materializing on her own body. Mio looked to her left and saw Griffin, grinning broadly, produce a folding signal mirror from an inside pocket of her jacket. And there she was, looking astonishedly back at herself, blank goggle lens on the wrong side, with the pointed black ears of a Carlsland fighting dog, of all things, but then witches don't pick their familiars, jutting up from her hair. "It's working," she said, her voice almost a whisper, and then, louder, "It's working." "It sure is," Griffin replied, tucking the mirror away. Approaching, he bent to make a couple of adjustments inside the engine access panels partway down both strikers, then clapped them shut and stood back, making a crossed fists gesture in front of his chest. "Contact!" "Contact!" Mio confirmed, willing the striker's engines to start turning. Like the magic engine initialization, or her shield when it had first come back, it felt strange at first. The machine's responses sluggish, as if it were resisting her. She felt a bit like a rookie, trying to get the striker to respond for the first time. The engines turned, but didn't fire at first, the mechanisms whining ineffectually. Then the left one caught, one cylinder firing, then another and another, The right followed a few seconds after that, and before long both were turning on their own. Training and experience took over automatically from nervous excitement now. As she'd been taught to do in flight school, Mio ran both engines up to full power in careful stages, warming them up and running them in, as you did immediately after a total overhaul. The right engine sputtered and banged, spitting black smoke from its exhaust stacks, and she nearly shut it down again before remembering that it always did that when it hadn't been run for a day or two. She could no longer hear Griffin, or indeed hear anything over the roar of her engines, but the next gesture he gave her, a whirl of an extended forefinger above his head, spoke clearly enough. Unable to keep a fierce grin from spreading onto her face, Mio engaged her Striker's propellers. The glowing energy blades sprang out from the spinning hubs, feathered but turning, blurring immediately into disks of light. His own expression mirroring hers, Griffin went to a nearby tree stump and picked up a hard-shelled, open-faced helmet with an aviation-style oxygen mask clipped to it, and strapped it on. Thus equipped, he crossed to the launch stage, carefully staying clear of the props, though, being ethereal, they wouldn't actually hurt him if he touched them, and unfastened the bungees that held her to the sawhorses. Then, in a gesture so perfectly chosen she'd have wept if she hadn't been so busy grinning, he took a couple of steps forward and to one side, turned to face the valley to the south, dropped to one knee, and swung his right hand forward, all the fingers extended, just like the deck crewmen on Fuseau witchcraft carriers did, to signal launch clearance. Mio's magic circle manifested on the ground beneath her, interdicting some of the local gravity and making it easier for her to lift off. She leaned forward, shifting her props to takeoff pitch. Another brief stutter, a cloud of black smoke, a wave of uncertainty so brief she barely recognized it. And Mio Sakamoto was flying again. It almost came as a surprise, the Shiden Kai leaping into the air so eagerly that she nearly lost control of it and ground-looped like a newbie. But she got hold of it before that could happen, throwing on a few seconds of emergency power so as to pile up as much airspeed as possible during the climb out. The valley fell away below her as she shot over the ridge at the end of the clearing where the cabin stood, providing a breathtaking vista of fall foliage rolling away toward the higher mountains. Head back, arms out, she pulled the steepest climb she could manage, the Striker's engines running smoothly now. Climbing was something the Shiden Kai Striker model was particularly good at, and she was at 20,000 feet before it occurred to her to look and see where Griffin might happen to be. Not entirely to her surprise, he was right next to her, in echelon formation to her right, just where, a little smile, Miyafuji would be. The exhaust of his jetpack showing cones of blue light. He grinned at her, then fastened his helmet's oxygen mask over his lower face, so that all she could see of his face was his smiling eyes behind the clear lenses of his goggles. Then, drawing the longer of his swords, he flipped it over and tapped her on the shoulder with its blunt edge, then half-rolled and dove inverted toward the forest. They hadn't had the equipment to rig up a radio link, but she didn't need one for that particular message, which was clear as day. Tag, you're it. Grinning, she drew Hagane Kaze and winged over to pursue him. They raced among the mountains for more than an hour, soaring to near her Striker's service ceiling and then diving back to the deck, executing ever more complicated maneuvers with finer and finer tolerances. His jetpack was faster, and capable of short bursts of astonishing speeds with its afterburners. But her Striker was more maneuverable, and as she regained more and more of her edge, she became able to demand ever greater feats of precision from it. The result was part race, part dogfight, part swordfight, and part dance, covering mile after mile of clear blue sky. At one point they streaked up a snow-filled coombe some miles to the north of the cabin, where the fall snowline had already reached the upper crag. their slipstreams and Griffin's jet exhaust blasting up a huge cloud of white in their wake. He pulled ahead during the part of it that was an outright drag race, but not so much as to be able to shake her. And when they reached the peak at the head of the valley, Mio's greater agility told. She treated it like a pylon at the end of an air racing course, pulling such a heavy turn around it that she left streamers of condensation from her Shidankai's winglet tips even in the dry mountain air, her vision momentarily pinking out in spite of her force-enhanced magical resilience. Griffin let her have that one, choosing instead to cut across the outer valley and intercept her at the bottom of the slope. She sensed him coming and tried out her new witch sight trick for the first time in the air. His closing speed seemed to fall away as her perception of time elongated. By the time he arrived at where she would have been, she was 5 degrees above, and giving him a sharp rap on top of the helmet with the back of Repu Maru, in the process of turning a complete vertical 360 over his head and settling in on his tail. He responded by chopping thrust and plummeting away, then turning himself over in free fall and cutting the power back on again so that he rocketed away in the opposite direction. Not a bad trick, that. Mio had seen him do it once over the English Channel, and it had completely flummoxed the Nuroi he'd done it to, setting it up perfectly for Sonya, making a rare daylight sortie, to blast it to pieces with her Fliegerhammer. This aerial exercise was bringing back a lot of memories like that, not just of him, but of all her wingmates. Things she'd put away in a box in the back of her head, too painful to look at when they were memories of a flying career that was over, and that were unpacking themselves joyously now that she was back in the air. It was time to go home. By some silent consensus, they wrapped up their dogfight shortly thereafter, returning to the clearing flushed, sweaty, and thoroughly exhilarated. Mio backed her striker carefully up to the improvised launch stage and balanced there while Griffin reaffixed the bungees. Then she shut down, powered off, and climbed out, sitting down on the top platform to catch her breath. Once disengaged from the striker, her legs tingled, muscles twitching, that familiar sensation that told her she'd put in a good hard day's work. Griffin pulled off his helmet and set it on the stage beside her, then held up a hand for a high five that turned into an arm wrestler's clasp and shoulder-to-shoulder half-hug. "Sakamoto Mio, you are back in business," he told her, grinning broadly. It started snowing while they were in the onsen, not that this discouraged them in any measurable way. Suspecting it might, they'd stashed all the hardware away in the shed again before calling it a day, so there was no urgent reason for them to cut short what they both knew, though neither was saying it aloud, would be their last hot soak together for a while. They didn't talk about it during their last meal together, either. Instead, the occasion was full of cheer, with celebratory toasts of tea to all Mio's beloved colleagues and confusion to the Nuroi, if they could in fact experience such a thing. They sat up into the small hours, talking of wars and hopes of peace, struggles and hopes of happiness, losses and hopes of love. When they turned in for the night, it wasn't to lie back to back, as had been their general custom, but face to face, though still with Wolfgang curled up happily between them. "Sleep well, Major," said Griffin softly, kissing her atop the head, and on this last night he left the rest of it unsaid. Breakfast the next day was a slightly subdued affair, but not somber. Rather, the mood was of slightly tense expectancy. It had snowed an inch or two during the night, but the morning was bright and clear, and warm enough that the snow had already started to melt by the time they finished breakfast. Feeling a bit ceremonious, Mio dressed in her uniform again, tying her hair up in its accustomed ponytail, then settled her swords on her shoulder and her new goggles on her head. Preparations complete, she descended the stairs and found Griffin in his working clothes, as he'd been dressed when they were working on her striker. He smiled at the sight of her in full flying trim again, gave her a hug, and asked her jokingly if she'd remembered to pack all her things. "I think I've got everything," she replied, half smiling. "Now the only thing left is to see if I can get home. Luckily," she added, "it seems part of me was thinking that far ahead, even when the rest of me wasn't." Griffin raised an eyebrow. "How so?" "To get back home the way I came," Mio explained, "I need something to guide me. Something I believe in as strongly as I believed in your coin to bring me here." She took her WDF flight test coin from her jacket pocket and carefully untied the black ribbon from around it, then pocketed the coin again and held the ribbon up. "And I think I have it right here." "What is it?" "It's Mina's tie, from her uniform. The day I left to come here..." Friday, April 13th, 1945. 501st Joint Fighter Wing Headquarters. Isola de la Strega. Adriatic Coast, Romagna. Late evening, and the deserted hangar was dark but for the glow of the Stryker launch stand's status lights. 10 green, their Stryker units in place and standing by, and 1 red, its retention brackets open and empty. Mio made a mental note of the red light as she silently entered the hangar. It meant Sonya Litviak was out there somewhere, on her usual lonely night patrol, and so might be a factor in what happened next. The Orussian Night Witch would probably not try to stop her, but that was hard to say for certain. She would, after all, certainly know that Major Sakamoto's flight was not authorized. Standing at the back of her Shidenkai Stryker unit's launch stage, Mio considered the dull gleam of the metal disc she held in her right hand, running her thumb gently over the lettering embossed on the reverse. She couldn't read it in this dim light, but she knew exactly what it said. It was the motto of the Wedge Defense Force's Experimental Flight Test Command, 3 words in a dead language that she'd been mulling over long into the nights lately. Citius, Altius, Fortius. "It's Latin," Griffin had explained when Erica Hartman had asked him what the slogan on his jacket patch said. "It means swifter, higher, stronger." With a sigh, Mio closed her fist around the coin, then climbed to the top of the launch stand. There, she kicked off her shoes, then paused, taking the moment fully on board. "How many times have I done this?" she wondered, looking down at the Stryker's empty leg ports. "Hundreds at least. And this will probably be the last." She felt like it ought to be more of an occasion, but it was what it was. Steeling herself, she walked to the end of the platform and jumped, her legs sliding into the Stryker's ports with practiced ease. As ever, there was the tingling rush as the magic engine energized, brightening her aura. Her familiar's ears and tail manifested. Her magic circle sprang into glowing existence on the floor beneath her. Smaller in diameter than it had once been, perhaps, but still bright and still complete. Her Shidenkai's engines came reluctantly to life, sputtering and missing, then settled into a steady thrum. It took more concentration than it used to, but yes, she could still do this. "Sakamoto heading out," she mumbled ironically as she tripped her launch stage's release and started taxiing toward the hangar doors, left standing open a few feet for Sonya's eventual return from patrol. She left her weapons behind, apart from Repumaru. Where she was going, she wouldn't need a gun. Halfway to the doors, Mio leaned forward, starting to pick up speed. She wanted to get out of sight of the base as fast as she could, in case anyone happened to be up and looking out a window. It wouldn't do for someone to raise the alarm before... A figure, barely visible in the dark, stepped into the gap between the doors, right in her path. Mio flinched, nearly losing control of her striker, and barely managed to stop herself before she ran the person down. She hovered awkwardly just outside the door for a moment, then settled herself to the ground, feathering her force props and leaving the engines at idle. This close, she could just make out the features of the person she'd nearly hit, who now stood before her, with her face set in a furious glare, and her heart sank. Of all the members of the squadron who might have intercepted her, Mina Dietlinde Wilke was the one she felt least able to cope with right now, and it had nothing at all to do with Mina being the only one who outranked her. "Going somewhere, Major?" Mina asked, completely failing in her attempt to sound nonchalant. "Mina," Mio replied helplessly. "What are you planning to do?" Mina inquired, her voice strangely cold. "Just disappear in the night? Vanish into legend? Keep flying until you can't anymore and plunge into the sea?" "No, Mio began, but Mina wasn't listening. The coldness in her voice suddenly flashed into fury as she slapped Mio across the face and barreled on. "Is that the way you Fuso witches resign from the game? Is it? How can you be so selfish? You might not be able to fight anymore, but there are 100 ways you can still be helpful to the war effort, to your country, to me. Damn you, Sakamoto, I need you!" The flash of anger burned itself out as quickly as it came, replaced not by a return to coldness, but by a sort of emotional collapse that would have been shocking to the junior members of the squadron if any had been around to see it. As a chilly spring rain began to fall, Mina crumpled against Mio's chest. With her striker on, even grounded, the latter was a good head taller than the former, and beat a fist ineffectually against her shoulder, sobbing,
"You weren't even going to say goodbye."
Mio supposed the thing to do now would be to set her commander aside and make a run for it. But even under her own present circumstances, her innate gallantry wouldn't let her do that. Instead, she waffled for a second, unsure what to do, and then experienced a moment of such perfect, crystalline clarity that she would remember it for the rest of her life. "Oh," she thought, "of course." Thankful for the rain, it kept it from being obvious that she was crying too, she gently repositioned herself, took Mina in her arms, and kissed her. Mina's brown eyes flew wide with shock, then closed as she leaned into the kiss. When it ended, Mio said softly, "Mina, I have to do this." Mina gazed into Mio's face, one cheek reddened, her bangs plastered down by the rain, for a long, searching moment. When she spoke again, it was in a brittle, barely audible voice.
"You're not coming back, are you?"
"Of course I'm coming back," Mio replied. And in that moment, the two women achieved a perfect understanding. Neither really believed it. Both knew that neither really believed it. But both wanted it to be true. And maybe, at a moment like this, that was enough. With an echo of her jaunty smile of old, Mio pulled at one end of Mina's black ribbon tie, unraveling the knot, then slipped the whole length of ribbon free from the commander's collar to hang entwined in the fingers of her left hand. "I'm not done with you yet," she added. Then she threw back her head and uttered her signature laugh, that maddening, magical laugh, and Mina knew that she wouldn't be able to stop her. As if in a dream, She stood motionless and let Mio slip past her, then fire up her striker again and soar away into the pitch-black, rainy night. She stood there in the dark, feeling the cool rain washing the hot tears from her face, until she could no longer hear the sound of the engines, as if Mio Sakamoto had flown off the edge of the world. "I didn't really know why I took it at the time," Mio mused. "I tied it around the coin, thinking it would be harder for me to lose it that way." Regarding the ribbon thoughtfully, she went on as if speaking to it rather than him. "I knew it would be important, but I didn't know why. And now... now I understand." She wound the ribbon several turns around her left wrist and carefully tied it, one-handed, in a practiced sailor's knot. Then, closing the hand into a fist, she held it against her chest and looked up to meet Griffin's eye. "It's going to take me back to her." He smiled. "You know," he said as she stepped into her borrowed army boots, but didn't lace them up, she'd be taking them off again soon enough, "when you said there had been a few weddings in the squadron, I was a little surprised when one of them wasn't Sakamoto Vilka." They went outside, heading for the shed, and started setting up the makeshift launch stage again, at which point he went on, "Until I thought about it for a second and realized, what am I saying? Mina's still her commanding officer. Barring really extraordinary circumstances, that'll have to wait until after the war." Mio chuckled a little ruefully. "You know me so well." "I hope so," said Griffin. "This nutty scheme probably wouldn't have worked if I didn't." "There's that," she admitted with a smile. Then tilted her head inquisitively and added, "Did you have a plan if it didn't?" "Sure. Plan B was, I teach you to fly an X-20DS, hook you up with one of Tesla's lightning rifles, and you go back to 1945 as the craziest damn ex-witch who ever lived."
"Ha ha ha! Now I'm almost sorry it worked," Mio said.
Then added with a wink that didn't really work because of her goggles, but he got the idea. "Almost." "Well, I could still get you the lightning rifle," he said. "Tempting, but I'd better not," said Mio, shaking her head. "Shirley would probably try to figure out how it works and end up frying herself. Or Lucchini." "Yeah, true. Hey, you know what?"
"What?"
"I'm going to miss you," said Griffin simply. "It's going to be too damn quiet around here with you gone."
"You'd be welcome if you came back with me," she said.
"I can't right now, but that's good to know." With a little grin, he went on, "I doubt this is the last time you'll see me."
"It had better not be," said Mio positively.
Then, her expression softening, she said in a quieter voice, "Listen, Benjamin, thanks again. I can't ever re..." Griffin placed his palm gently against her cheek, surprising her into silence as his grin became a warmer smile.
"You don't have to," he said. "Just seeing you get back your fire, knowing I had something to do with it, that's payment enough."
Mio reddened slightly, smiling. Then, with a sudden decisive vigor that took him by surprise, she seized him by collar and nape and laid a diligent and competent kiss on him, delivered like the meticulous technician she was.
"Of course, that's a perfectly acceptable completion bonus," he conceded, sounding a little dazed, when at length she turned him loose.
"That one's not from Erica," Mio said, then added with a faint smirk, "so you can tell Trudeau about it all you want." Griffin shook his head, mocked sadly at her. "Mina's gonna have you fixed," he said. Then, Clapping his hands briskly together, he continued, "Speaking of whom, what do you say, Major? Let's get you back to the wife and kids."
"Ow!
You hit like a girl." He rubbed his shoulder, giving her a wounded look, and added, "I mean it, that really hurt." "I hit like a witch," Mia corrected him, and they laughed as he helped her on with her striker unit, then stood clear. Grinning an exultant grin as her aura brightened and her ears and tail sprang out, he doubted one would happen without the other for a while yet. She fired up the unit, rising to a low hover as the glowing takeoff sigil appeared on the ground beneath her. For a moment she remained there, running the props to full RPM in hover pitch, filling the clearing with the full-throated voice of a perfectly tuned striker, and regarding him with a hard-to-read little smile. Then, in a heartbeat, she straightened to perfect aerial attention, her face hardening into its most professional set, and snapped off a crisp salute, which he returned as cleanly as he knew how. "Sakamoto Mio Shosa, Hashin!" she barked, her voice carrying clearly above the roar of her striker, and then she crashed the props into takeoff pitch and sprang into the sky after such a short run that it almost seemed like a vertical launch. Almost as soon as she was airborne, she pulled a heavy Immelmann turn, a climbing half-loop with a rollout at the top, and, with a second, much jauntier salute and a grin as she flew past him, streaked northward toward the snowy peaks. A minute or two later, she reappeared heading south again, now passing much higher overhead and gathering speed as she raced out over the valley. The roar of her props became a snarl as the tips became supersonic. Even in broad daylight from this far away, Griffin could see her aura, shedding rays and rivulets of silver light in her wake as a conical transonic shockwave formed just ahead of her. With a silvery pseudomotive flash that reminded him of a starship leaping to hyperspace, and a concussive noise that was no mere sonic boom, she vanished, leaving behind a spreading bullseye of vapor rings in the reverberating air. Orphaned energy sparkled amid the rings, its crackle rippling down in the thunder's wake, like the sound of distant fireworks. He stood looking up at the slowly diffusing shock rings until they were nearly gone, then sighed, called to Wolfgang, and walked back toward the cabin. "Guess I can finish that book now," he mused a little glumly.
"Herf,"
Wolfgang replied. "And tomorrow," Griffin went on as he entered the building, "I suppose I might as well start working on those lightsaber techniques." Saturday, April 14th, 1945. Disputed airspace, 25 nautical miles northeast of Bari, Romania. Lieutenant Colonel Mina Dietlinda Vilka was not a happy woman. She was rarely happy in battle, though a thoroughly competent and largely fearless aviator with a long and illustrious combat record. She wasn't one of those people who enjoyed fighting, like Hartman or Lucchini. It was just a job to her, an important one to be sure, but not any kind of spiritual calling. That had little to do with her dudgeon today, though. Today, she was angry because the Nuroi that was on course for Bari had interrupted her plans to dispatch the 501st Joint Fighter Wing on a critical search and rescue mission. At the very moment when she'd finished briefing the squadron about the unauthorized and very upsetting departure of her executive officer and was about to send them all out in search of her, the alert siren sounded, and now they were all out here wasting time with this, while Mio... She shook her head, angry with herself now for thinking about that while she and the others had a job to do. There was absolutely nothing to be gained by entertaining imaginary scenarios of what might have happened to Mio after she'd flown away into the rainy, blustery night, what might be happening to her now. After the previous day's action, the only operational member of the squadron, when Mina had recovered her wits and realized what a fool she'd been to just let Mio leave like that, had been its night witch. Poor, patient Sonya, out there alone in that drenching rain all night, had searched the pitiless dark in vain until her strength nearly failed her, returning heartbroken to confess defeat and fall into bed in virtually the same motion. Utterly exhausted, she hadn't woken or even stirred while Ayla peeled her sodden uniform off her and bundled her properly into a dry duvet. Mina had to wait 12 hours before any other member of the squadron would be in a fit state to go after the Major, hoping against hope all the while that Mio would come sheepishly back and take her rightful bollocking like the upright soldier she was. And now this. The whole squadron felt it. They all loved Mio, had all been worrying about her for some time now as it became obvious that she was, bad enough, losing her edge and, worse, doggedly refusing to accept the inevitable. Being unable to pursue her immediately ate at all of them. They had chafed all day at their enforced inactivity, and their frustration at this new development was hampering their ability to focus every bit as much as it was hampering their commander's. Their tactics were ragged, their cohesion almost non-existent. Anyone familiar with the legend of the 501st would have been nonplussed to see their sorry showing on this day, and in some part of her mind, Mina began to feel a very real fear that before it was over, one or more of them would be seriously hurt. As she thought it, so it suddenly seemed certain, as the Neuroi, a slow-moving but vast specimen capable of agglomerating multiple beams into a single strike, tagged Miyafuji so heavily that it crashed her shield and sent her spinning toward the sea, her cannon hanging by its shoulder strap. Crying out her name, Lynette Bishop dove after her, the engines of her Mark 22 Spitfire howling at full emergency power. "I'm all right," Miyafuji's voice crackled on the squadron's tactical band. "Stay on the target. Your perine's only cover now." "She's learned to think tactically," thought Mina with an abstract flicker of pride, which was almost immediately swamped by another wave of horror as the Neuroi, as if it knew Bishop was out of place, turned its attention to Perrine Klosterman. With a stifled cry, Lynn pulled out of her dive and raced back up, but Mina could see that it would take the young Englishwoman several seconds to get back into position. "Shirley!" Mina cried, thinking to direct the fastest flyer in the squadron to support Perrine. The Galleon was showing distinct signs of fatigue, and Mina wasn't sanguine about her shield's chances against one of those massed beams if Miyafuji's, by far the strongest in the group, hadn't stood up to it. Jaeger was clear at the other end of the whale-like Neuroi, though. Too far for even her legendary speed to get her to Perrine's side in time, and Mina felt her stomach clench as she ran out of time to find another solution. With a sound that Erica Hartman would later describe in a letter to her twin sister Ursula as like thunder if thunder happened in a U-Bahn tunnel, the clear blue sky above the Neuroi seemed to split open, visibly fracturing like a hammered mirror. Behind it, for the briefest instant, those who were looking at the time caught a glimpse of some swirling purple unreality too hideously alien for the mind to comprehend. Before they could even really try to do so, though, it had gone, the fabric of reality re-knitting itself in a heartbeat, and some small object shrouded in brilliant silver light smashed into the upper hull of the Neuroi. Emitting a weird howling noise that felt almost like a cry of dismay, the massive alien craft buckled in the center, its prow and stern pitching sharply upward, and those nearest to the point of impact could have sworn they heard a voice cry, "Ichiro no sen!" The silver light expanded outward into an arc and scythed through the Neuroi, cutting it clean in two from the point of impact. The two halves fell away from each other, already disintegrating into fragments of white light, and a puff of blood-red radiance at the center announced the destruction of the core for all to see. What the hell did I just see? Shirley Yeager inquired on the TAC band. Was that a meteor? Ayla Jutilainen wondered. Not even you are that lucky, objected Gertrude Barkhorn. I know, right? Hartman agreed. It's not luck, it's skill, Ayla grumbled. Wait, Miyafuji's voice interjected as she, a bit shakily, joined the regrouping formation. In the middle. Is that? Mina, swooping in to join the others, looked where she was pointing, and a moment later she saw what Yoshika was talking about. There was a figure at the center of the disintegrating Neuroi, just becoming visible as the cloud of luminous particles it had burst into began to diffuse and fall away. It's... Lynn gasped, her fist to her mouth. Well, I'll be dipped, said Shirley. Holy cow! Francesca Lucchini squeaked. Major Sakamoto! Cried Perrine, her voice ramping up to something not too unlike a scream of delight. And so it was. Standing four square on her props in the midst of the slowly dissipating debris, with two swords on her back and her fists on her hips, was Mio Sakamoto. Ha ha ha! The Major declared, all her teeth showing in an enormous grin. That's right, ladies. Daddy's home. Mina throttled up and dove toward her, getting out ahead of the rest of the squadron as they all converged. She was not entirely sure whether she would kiss her wayward exec first or punch her, but either way, she had no doubt that it was going to be a serious breach of military etiquette. And right now, she didn't care a damn. This is going to completely mess up the chain of command, Barkhorn mumbled, her eyes like saucers. Beside her, Hartman just giggled. Avery Productions Unlimited, Flying Yak Studios, and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Lensman, The Brave and the Bold, New Tricks. Written and directed by Benjamin D. Hutchins, that's me, with the gracious assistance of the usual suspects. Based on characters from Strike Witches, created by Humikane Shimada. Music by Queen. Bacon Comics Chief, Derek Bacon. International Police Organization, Galactic Headquarters, 299 Allard Avenue, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. Office of the Chief, Personal Memorandum, February 8th, 2410. Boys and girls, I just finished looking through the script for the Brave and the Bold Summer Special. In the interest of historical completeness, I should note for the record that you have conflated a number of different occurrences there, most of which did in fact not happen during my Ishiyama retreat. There is also rather more kissing depicted here than I remember. However, it all hangs together and all of the individual happenings are reasonably accurate, and the feel of it is right, which is of course the important thing. I agree with Shimada when he says we should revisit the 501st in future B and the B episodes. For that matter, they're mighty colorful characters and could easily carry a spin-off all by themselves. We might also want to talk to TV Tomodachi about the possibility of a crossover with Fly Girls. I know my son Corwin would get a big kick out of that. Nice work, as always. When I watch an episode of B and the B and think, it didn't happen that way, but geez, I wish it had, that's when I know you've nailed it. Mahalo, G.